National Public Radio. It's 29 minutes after 2 o'clock, and this is Fresh Air. You're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. In just a couple of minutes, my guest on the studio, in the studio will be one of the most interesting jazz trombonists I know, Jimmy Nepper. He's in Philadelphia to perform at the Bijou with the Mingus Dynasty Band, a band comprised mostly of musicians who played with the late bass player and composer Charles Mingus. The band plays the music of Charles Mingus. Jimmy Nepper played with Mingus off and on from about 57 through 61. During that time, he recorded some exceptional work with Mingus. We're going to be hearing some of his recordings with Charles Mingus during the next hour, and we'll also be hearing some of his recently recorded work. We're going to open now with a session recorded in 1959, a piece written by Charles Mingus called Jelly Roll. Recorded in 1959 under the leadership of the tune's composer, Charles Mingus. That was Jelly Roll. We heard my guest, Jimmy Nupper, featured on trombone. Jimmy Nupper is in Philadelphia to perform tonight at the Bijou with the Mingus Dynasty Band. It's a band comprised mostly of musicians who have played with Mingus. He has done a number of the arrangements for the band and is the featured trombonist with the band. They'll be performing at the Bijou tonight. Jimmy Nupper, it's such a pleasure to have you here and to meet you. I've enjoyed your music for quite a while. Since you're here with the Mingus Dynasty Band tonight, I thought that we could start talking about your work with Charles Mingus. How did you first meet? How did you first join his band?
Well, I first met Mingus about 1945 in Los Angeles. We had a band with Dean Benedetti, first bebop band in Los Angeles. And we needed a bass player one night. Our bass player couldn't make some job. I think it was in San Pedro. And so Dean got Mingus. And years later, when I joined him in New York in the jazz workshop, he told me that that was the first white band he'd ever worked with and that he remembered us for that reason. Later in that year, he had a job at Billy Berg's, and he hired the trumpet player Dale Snow and I to work with him at Billy Berg's. And I also made a record with him, probably a demonstration record at that time for a bigger band. And then in 1957, about January, I had come back from Europe with working with Claude Thornhill, and a friend of mine, Willie Dennis, a trombone player, said that he was leaving Mingus's band and that Mingus could use a trombone. So I was about to call him. I didn't really remember him, and Mingus called me and asked me to come and rehearse with him. So we got down a few tunes. He taught us a few tunes. Shafi Hadi was in the band then, and we started our working together in 1957. And shortly, at the end of that month, I think we made our first record, The Clown, or the first record that I made with the Mingus band. The Clown on Atlantic Records. And then there was a bunch of other record dates that various tunes come from and were put together on different albums.
Was there advice that Mingus gave you when you first joined the band? Did he tell you what he wanted from you right at the start, or did he make some initial comments to let you know what was expected of you?
No, but he taught us his tunes in such a way and explained that here we'll have a free section, which was, he was one of the pioneers in that respect. He was doing a lot of the things that they're doing today. He was doing 20 years ago, starting something like that, like the what you might call a vamp. To ready. He had the idea of making it a building situation where the musicians that were playing were involved in the construction of the piece itself, and you would have something that was organized and then play this free section, starting softly or simply, and building it up to a crescendo or some sort of climax, and then going on to another section with a cue somewhere or other. And that was one of the new things about Mingus's writing. It was like that. There was a bunch of pieces like that, too. Pithecanthropus Erectus and Jump Monk, Passions of a Woman or Man. Well, there were a bunch of them. A lot of tunes had that same kind of formula.
Were there things that he did in the band that you thought were really inspirational for you and the other musicians when it came time for you to take your solos?
Something that he did inspiration? No, he just played. If he was playing good, playing rhythmically, it was inspiration, because he was a tremendous bass player. He could swing like crazy. He didn't feel like it all the time, or he, at times, he felt that the nice rocking swing wasn't what he wanted. So, when some occasions came about like that, the band was rhythm section was grooving away. He'd do something to put a stumbling block and get something else going other than that Count Basie feeling or Duke Ellington feeling. Strict, good rhythm section that he would stick out his foot and trip you up some way if he could.
Cy Johnson said that his tunes were sometimes such obstacle courses because of the difficult chords and chord changes, and because of the arrangements. And by the time you got a solo, if he let you just play free for a few bars there, there was such a sense of release after having emerged from this obstacle course that you just soared.
That could have been true. The tunes weren't easy. Some of them were very difficult. In fact, I've heard some of them. I kind of imagine how in the world I ever learned that thing by heart, even. And I knew that this one particular tune I'm thinking of, I know that I played it from memory, but hearing it lately after years, I just can't imagine how I did it.
Do you listen back to your records that you made with Mingus?
Pardon?
Do you ever listen back to the records that you made with Mingus?
No, I don't even have them, so I can't reflect on them.
Do you have any of your records?
Yeah, some a few I have, but I've never gone and listened. I have to have had to lately because I've been playing with this Mingus band, and to try to pick out what tunes to do out of the ones that I know and the ones that I don't know, and what would be good for the band to do, what we can do, what we can't do. So I've had to hear a few of them.
When Ted Curson, who was a trumpet player with Mingus in around 60-61, was on the
yes.
show, he said that his memories of playing with Mingus is having to keep one eye on the music and one eye on Mingus because he never knew what he was going to do. There's one now legendary story about what Mingus did with you that I'd really love to hear, and I'd really love to hear you tell it. It's a story that I've heard told by other people, a story that have had a very profound effect on your life and on your relationship with Mingus.
Oh, you probably mean the Town Hall concert.
The Town Hall concert, yeah.
He had a concert at Town Hall that he had a warning of it about 2 months or whatever in front of it, and he started out. I hadn't been playing with him for some time, and he asked me to help him prepare the music for it. So I'd go over to his apartment and copy some of the music that he had done. He scored very slowly, and as we went on, he kept adding horns to this essentially small band. He added a few horns to the two horns that he had in the band, and then more and more, and it finally ended up with about 6 trumpets and 8 saxophones, 6 trombones, 2 drummers, 2 pianos, 2 basses. I forget all what was there, but it was a gigantic band, and he didn't have material for it, so he farmed out some of the writing to some other one, the trumpet player that was playing with him at the time. And I recommended some arrangers, and he had them do some pieces. He had his cousin do a piece, and he pulled out some old arrangements that he had done for Lionel Hampton. And he was under great pressure because this concert meant a great deal to him, appearance in Town Hall, and he hadn't been too active at the time. So when the final day came around, there was to be a midnight rehearsal, and the arrangements to flesh out the program came in, and it was too much for me by myself to do, so I took the work to a copying service, and I was supervising the copying. And Mingus asked me that afternoon to come up to his apartment. He wanted me to do something, so I went up there, and he wanted me to write some backgrounds for solos, and I just said, Mingus, no, this is your music, and you should write the backgrounds yourself. At which point he, probably due to the pressure that he was under, he said, oh, you don't want to help me, you're trying to undermine me, and he lashed out, and he happened to hit me in the mouth, and he broke off a cap tooth I had, and he broke off the stub that it was attached to, and that kind of severed my relationship with Mingus for quite a few years. I didn't have anything to do with him for quite a while after that. I didn't see him for about maybe 10 years. And that's all there is to that story.
Must have been really difficult for you as a trombone player to have a tooth that was now missing.
Well, he might have done me a favor in a sense, or God might have done me a favor, and that he put me out of the jazz business for those years in which jazz was not a very marketable product. There wasn't very many opportunities to play. It was in the doldrums at that time. Rock and roll was taking over. And I think after that, I don't think Mingus was active for very much. And he tried to get a school going, and I went to work for a living. I played Broadway show and did bread and butter work at this time. And if I'd have kept being exclusively a jazz player, I might have ended up a very bitter person because of the non-opportunities there were at that time. So that's 50 lifetimes ago.
When did you meet up with Mingus again?
Well, I saw him one time. He came down to the Village Vanguard when I was playing with Thad Jones and muttered a few words to me then. And then a few years later, I saw him and we began to be a little more cordial. And then I did one date of a great big band. I don't know what the record was. It might have been that My Children Hear Music album. But it was, a lot of it was overdubs, and all I played was the basic track, so I couldn't really say. And then I did the, he asked me to do a Newport Jazz in New York concert with him, featuring the Tijuana Table Dance that we used to do, and he got some Spanish dancers, some mariachi, what do you call those?
Mariachi?
No, no.
Maracas?
No, the Spanish dance, the stomping kind of dance.
Flamenco?
Flamenco, yeah. A group of flamenco dancers to be on stage and dance to this Tijuana Table Dance. And they listened to the record and they figured out a routine. And the record was copied.
And, oh, this is a few years ago.
Yeah, a few years ago. So we did that, and George Wein was very surprised. He was, oh, my God, flamenco dances, what is this? But it was a big hit, and Mingus got out after it was over, and he danced a little bit, and the piano player danced. And it came off very well. After that, I played, I think the next year it was, too, we did a concert at the Newport Festival. And there was a record date of what do they call it? Cumbia and jazz.
Fusion.
And then the next year, he had become very sick by that time. He was paralyzed. And the next record date was the last one, me, myself.
And I.
And I. That he didn't participate on. He didn't play on it. He was kind of consultant of the arranging and all that.
Did he ever apologize to you for that punch?
No.
Did you feel like he owed you an apology?
This is something that you live through, and I had never dwelled on it, aside from a few years after it happened. For some reason or other, Mingus had respected my... I don't know what to call it, my understanding of his music, which I really can't understand at all. He thought that I understood his music better than some other people. What reason, I have no idea. And on his last birthday, I was in Boston at the time, and I called him up and wished him happy birthday. And he asked me to come over, that they were ruining his music. And he had been singing to a metronome into a tape recorder, some melodies. The melodies were transcribed. And he had some piano players work with him to put harmony to them, which was a surprise to me because I didn't know that he worked that way, that he would hear a melody and then figure out how the harmony went by playing different chords and see if he could get what he heard. And he couldn't do that because he was paralyzed. And he didn't like the chords that the piano players wrote, so he asked me to do it, which I'm not a piano player, and the piano players can play 16 chords, different inversions and whatever, while I'm figuring out how to play two. But I harmonized a couple of them, and he seemed happy with it. And the last time I played anything of his before he died was at another Newport festival. There was a band that went up and did a tribute to Mingus at Saratoga. And coming back, I started to think about a piece that he had done, that we had done, the first album I made with him, as a matter of fact, a tune called Reincarnation of a Lovebird. And I got a couple of lines and kept working on it. And about 6 months later, I'd finished it, and I sent it to him, a poem that was lyrics, you might say, to the tune. That is, the words were in coordination with the melody that he wrote. So I sent it to him, and he read it before he died, or it was read to him before he died. So I think we've made our peace.
Is it a pleasant experience for you now to be playing Mingus's music again with the Dynasty Band, with other musicians who played with him during different periods? Are you enjoying the
Oh, yeah, it's nice to see.
Band?
It's nice to see and play with the players, because they're all tremendous. Every one of them is a whiz.
You know, it's funny. I bet a lot of the people who come and hear you play could whistle the solos that you took on some of the tunes on recordings. And since you don't have any of the records, you probably don't remember those solos.
No, I don't.
Yeah. Let's listen to one of the sessions that you recorded with Mingus. This is a piece called Flamingo. It's from the Tijuana Moods record. This is the album that features the recording Isabel's Table Dance, which Jimmy Nepper referred to a few minutes ago. That's the one with the flamenco dancing within it. And this features Jimmy Nepper on trombone. The trumpeter on this recording is Clarence Shaw. Charles Mingus featured on bass. Do you want to say a few words about the session before we hear it?
Yeah, it's a shame that this record wasn't done or released at the time that we played the tune. It was a mini hit as far as playing it live in clubs go. We played it every night, sometimes twice a night.
You're talking about the table dance?
Yeah, we knew it as Tijuana Table Dance.
So we're going to be hearing Flamingo, by the way.
And it was quite a piece. It took about 15 minutes to play, which was very long at that time. And the people responded to it. They requested it, but the tune wasn't recorded to a few months after that, and then it wasn't released for years and years, and it didn't do Mingus any good at all by that time. In fact, I think he played it a little bit after that, after the record was released, but the record was also edited in such a way that it was the whole format was changed around. When I first heard it, I didn't even recognize it, because the introduction of the it went from the introduction, and it was cut, scissored to a part way in the middle of it, and then they had the first part come in again, and then it was all switched around, the different sections. And so I was surprised that Mingus would allow something like that to happen.
From that same album, we're going to be hearing Flamingo. Do you remember anything about the recording of that piece?
The only thing I remember was the harmony sure sounded strange. There was only two horns, I think, wasn't there? And he had us play some notes that seemed far out at the time. The whole piece is arranged except for the obvious solos, and the harmony notes are what Mingus wanted to hear. It's quite an extraordinary orchestration for just two horns.
Let's hear it. This is Flamingo. My guest, Jimmy Nepper, featured on trombone. The trumpeter is Clarence Shaw. Thank you. From the Charles Mingus record, Tijuana Moods, we heard Flamingo. My guest Jimmy Nepper was featured on trombone, Clarence Shaw on trumpet, and Shafi Hadi on alto saxophone. Before joining Mingus's band in the late 50s, I know you played with a lot of big bands. Was that a pleasant experience? Was it mostly jazz that you were playing, or dances with foxtrots and novelty tunes? How were you enjoying that?
I didn't play with a lot of bands, but I did play with some of the dance bands, and that's what they were, primarily dance bands. They played dance music for dancers. They played ballrooms and things like that. There were hardly any concerts at all. In fact, I can't even think of playing any concerts with any dance bands. And they weren't jazz bands at all. There might have been some jazz soloists, but they were very limited. They played 16 bars or 12 bars, maybe a whole chorus, big deal at that time. And you played the popular music of the day, and you made the one-nighters and whatever.
Who were some of the best band leaders that you worked with?
Probably the best was Stan Kenton. He was a very real gentleman and very sensitive to musicians and a very thoughtful fellow, too. Woody Herman's a nice guy. Gil Evans is a It was a real thrill to work with him. Thad Jones had a lot of exuberance. It was quite an experience with him. It was a lot of fun when I, some of the times when I played with him. Some of the others I hardly feel like mentioning. Ralph Martieri, very commercial band. He had a good band, though. Freddie Slack. See who else did I work for.
You know, people always use the word work for when talking about a big band. That sounds like working for a company. You know, sometimes when people talk about some of the older big bands.
Well, I didn't. I played with some bands. I don't really consider myself as having gone through that period because I didn't stay with any of them very long. I mean, I never made any year-long road tours or anything like that. 16 weeks or 6 weeks or whatever it was something happened to enable me to escape somehow. Like I was working with Ralph Martieri in 1956, and my wife got sick and had to go to the hospital, so that got me off of that band. So I had to mill around Chicago and played with Johnny Bothwell there, met some of the Chicago musicians, and later went on to New York. And I was playing with Claude Thornhill, and then I happened to meet again with Mingus and join him, and that got me out of that situation. I've never made any long extended tours on a bus or anything like that, so some of the fellows that have, that's outside of my experience. I have done some tours, but nothing real strenuous like some of the old days.
The trombone has always been an important instrument in the big band, and it's a much less prominently featured instrument in small group sessions. I've been hearing a lot about the renaissance of the trombone. There really did seem to be a time when the trombone had practically faded from visibility in small group jazz settings. Do you feel that way? And if so, how has that affected your life as a trombonist?
Well, in small bands, the trombone would be one of the last horns to be added. That is, you'd have a saxophone and a trumpet, and even maybe another saxophone before you'd have one trombone. And the economics of small bands has been such that it's unusual that they have a small jazz band that has three horns or four horns. And if you do have a small band with three or four or five horns, it involves arranged music. And it's more like kind of like a miniature big band. That those situations don't come up very often. Because in the tradition that we've come up on, that is the bebop bands, and it was two horns, trumpet and alto, or trumpet and tenor, or maybe alto and tenor. And trombone, there wasn't much opportunity. That is, in the bebop era, there's probably only one trombone player that was J.J. Johnson that was... had very much opportunity at all to play. Later there was Curtis Fuller and Julian Priester, but even they had to scuffle for opportunities to play.
How do you explain that? Do you think that the trombone had negative associations because of big bands? Were people having trouble playing really fast licks on it, bop licks, because of the slide?
Yeah, that's probably true. There hasn't been, until lately, any real... virtuoistic players and trumpet players and saxophone players have got into that virtuoso stage or much faster execution. They did it years ago. They've developed in that stage where trombone hasn't developed that fast. And there still aren't really many people that can play with any great deal of fluency. That is the way that saxophone and trumpet are played.
Do you think that bop maybe put too much of an emphasis, let me rephrase this. Do you think bop left us placing too strong an emphasis on speed and on lots of notes?
That is a very legitimate question, because some players are obsessed with that, and it's kind of a criterion of how well you play, how fast you can play, how many notes you can play, what, how long runs you can do. And that's really not what music is about. It's not a... it shouldn't be, in my estimation, it shouldn't be a show-off kind of situation, a virtuistic exhibitionism, let us say. It's supposed to be music, not an exhibition.
I know Parker had a really strong effect on you when you first heard his music. How did that affect what you were doing, and how did you develop the ears and the fingers to get down the bop licks that you wanted to play and to incorporate the new things that you were hearing in your own playing?
Well, by hearing them. You heard something and you recognize what you hear, and you associate it with a key that you're in, and your ear develops. That is, even beginners can have some sort of ear. Even somebody that hasn't worked at it has developed some sort of recognition of the relationship of intervals, relationship between notes, that they can reproduce it if, in their voice and later with their instrument. And it comes to be part of their background, so that they do hear something, then it's possible for them to express it in their horns by moving their fingers or playing this note and that note. And so when we heard Charlie Parker, for me it was more a realization of why we were doing these things. This is to make music. As Bird was a very musical player. And before that time, he was outstanding because he had a different way of articulation. He was very articulate on his horn. That is, he had a syllable for every note he played. And before that time, a lot of players would just make runs on their instrument, just fingering them. But Bird played very succinctly. He mouthed everything he did. It was like speaking on a horn, and it came out music. And for me, the revelation was that this was the object of all the background and the technique and whatever that you had, was to make music.
Now, Parker had a strong effect on you, but you have your own style. Did you, like, develop your own style consciously? Did you work at getting your own voice, or did your own voice just naturally evolve through your instrument?
I think it just naturally evolved, because we tried to imitate what we heard. Like one time, the Lester Young solos, the very classic ones that probably all the tenor players, at least of that generation, could sing, and they were memorable. This very simple little motifs that Perez played were absorbed by the musical community, and we used to play them to get us in the kind of the mood that we wanted to play in, or the kind of style that we wanted to have, that free sounding fluency that Perez had, and later Charlie Parker. And by copying and trying to emulate these players, our styles, at least my style, emerged. A lot of the things I still do are, you can probably hear Charlie Parker or Lester Young or whoever in it. And it became part of me, and I don't think anybody's got a monopoly on the scale. The way they played it, the way it comes out on particular horns. That is, all the people that imitate Charlie Parker or Lester Young do their best, but some of their own individuality comes through, and you can't imitate somebody the rest of your life. I guess you could, but it's not too good an idea. And eventually something of their own will creep into it. You can say they're influenced by whoever, but their own self will come through.
There are now on the market a lot of jazz books that have transcriptions of Parker's solos and just short bop phrases that you can learn in every key and patterns that you could use in your own playing or improvising. There's transcriptions. I know there's a lot of Parker books, and I'm sure that there's books in the modes of many other musicians. That's all relatively new, I think. You didn't have anything like that to work with, I'd imagine, when you were playing. Would you find for your students, for instance, books like that useful? Do you think that's a valid way of learning to play jazz?
Well, I went through that myself. Dean Benedetti, a saxophone player that's dead now, and I went up to his parents' house in Susanville, California, near Reno, and we transcribed. This is about 1903, I think. so long ago. 1946, 47, 48, somewhere around there, 49. We transcribed most of the commercial records that were out. We transcribed Charlie Parker solos and agonized over what note this was, and we kept hearing swallowed notes and things that Bird played that were only evident at a half speed. And we thought we did a pretty good job on them, and we tried to play along with the record, and we developed some different kind of technique than what we had before. That is, this has been done for years and years, and Louis Armstrong, Bix Beiderbecke, and everybody else. And I understand Charlie Parker played Lester Young solos. But this only goes so far in that you eventually have to play something of yourself. And the idea behind it is more important than the technique that you gain from practicing that.
Well, following through on when you were forming a solo, do you have an idea of what that is and what that's going to be? Is there a musical or even pictorial shape in your mind before you begin playing a solo? Do you have a sense of the direction you're taking it in?
Usually not. I may think of the first phrase to play, the first few notes, but beyond that it's more intuition, and I'm relying on my background, my memory, and what I've experienced, and emotion, and whatever else has gone into my makeup, that it comes out intuitively.
Let's listen to a recently recorded session under your leadership. This is an album that was released on Steeplechase, and it's now making its way into the States. Steeplechase is from what, Sweden?
Denmark.
Denmark. And the album is called Cunning Bird. We're going to hear a selection that's written by Jimmy Nepper. It's a piece called Languid, and the other people on the session are Al Cohn, who's featured on tenor sax, Roland Hanna at the piano, George Mraz bass, and Danny Richmond, another person very associated with Charles Mingus, featured on drums. Do you want to say anything about this album?
Well, it was put together over the weekend, and they're all originals on it. The fellow that produced the album, Niels Winther, asked me who I wanted on it, and like another horn, and I thought, gee, who I'd like to get? Al Cohn, yeah, why not? And everybody I called was available. Roland Hanna, George Mraz, and he was willing to fly Danny Richmond up from North Carolina, so that an album that was put together over the weekend, it came off pretty well.
Sure is. It's a really nice record. Let's listen to Languid from this album under the leadership of my guest, trombonist Jimmy Nepper.
Thank you.
Heard Languid, a composition by trombonist Jimmy Nepper, who was featured on trombone, Al Cohn was featured on tenor, Danny Richmond on drums, George Mraz bass, Roland Hanna at the piano. It's from a Jimmy Nepper album on the Steeplechase record label, an album that is available in the States. The album's called Cunning Bird. I've been surprised, actually, Jimmy Nepper, at the limited number of albums under your name that one can find. I wonder why that is.
Well, I made one in 1957 with Mingus's label, debut, with Joe Maney on alto. And as far as I know, it was only released in Denmark. And I made another with Pepper Adams and I, were the new international critics, new stars of 1950 or whatever. And Leonard Feather had a great idea. Oh, Pepper and Nepper, they rhyme. So we made an album, and the company immediately went out of business. And that's, I think that's re-released in Japan. I haven't seen it, but that's a collector's item, I guess. And then this album you have was called A Swinging Introduction to Jimmy Nepper on Bethlehem. And after I made that, they immediately went out of business. And years later, their catalog was sold to whoever bought it. And they were looking and they saw, oh, Bill Evans, yeah. So they did a montage photograph, put a new cover on it, and released it as Jimmy Nepper with Bill Evans.
It's a nice record. It's a real nice record.
Yeah, it's Gene Quill and Gene Roland and Ted Kodak and Bill Evans. I think there's another piano player on one of the sides, too. Mm. Is there?
I don't recall. Yeah, Bob Hammer, who you mentioned in connection with Mingus.
Mm-hmm.
You've done a number of gigs and continue to that are not jazz. You were saying when you left Mingus, you played in the pit band for Funny Girl for a while.
I did the entire Broadway run, 1,348 performances. I didn't do them all, but I was...
Now, that is very non-jazz, to play the arrangements for a show like Funny Girl. Did you enjoy that? Was it something very related to your music, or did you see it as a job completely separate from what you, as a trombonist,
It was completely separate. It was a dead-end job, for one thing. And it was probably it's the longest job I've ever worked in one place. Actually, we played in about four different theaters, but that salary went on for over 3 years. That's unprecedented, at least in my life. And saved some money and got established in a house, and it was bread and butter work. It can be very depressing, and I just went up and down in moods and essentially just went in and did the job and came home and spent 3 years in limbo almost. In fact, when it finally ended, I was wondering what I could do. I was almost out of the music business. But things picked up again.
Is it hard to play your own stuff after playing a job like that? I know for myself, the times when I've had jobs that I thought of as, you know, easy jobs, you just do your job, you get through it, and then you could come home and do what you want to do. You're so tired from doing that job, even if it doesn't demand a lot of thought and a lot of creativity and spur-of-the-moment thinking. Jobs like that usually tend to take up a lot of energy, and when you're blowing all night, whether, you know, it's for improvisational music or whether you're reading a fairly simple score, you're still blowing and it's really tiring. Were you able to work on your own stuff when you got home?
Well, that job wasn't tiring at all. In fact, that was one of the features of it. One of the good things, if you can consider it good, is that you didn't even have to stay in any kind of shape to play the job. In fact, I went in sick and tired and headache and everything, and you just pull yourself together to play a few bars or whatever you have to do, and then you collapse back in your chair again and snooze until the next cue comes along. It's not very challenging. It's not challenging at all. And it's like just doing your job. It's something you know how to do, and you do it easily enough, and there's no mental strain or anything else involved with it. And when you have some job like that, when you do have opportunity to play, you can explode. You have all things, all sorts of feelings pent up inside you, and when you get an opportunity to play, you just go overboard.
How do things strike you now as far as work for jazz musicians, work for trombonists? We were talking a little bit about how the trombone seemed to slip out of fashion for a while.
Well, the trombone is probably still out of fashion. Some players have made it a little more prominent, but it's still regarded, I think, as a kind of a lyrical, sweet-sounding solo instrument, say Tommy Dorsey or Herbie Green style. The trombone is a utility instrument, and it does have a place in music, jazz music, if only for that. It can flesh out just like it did in the dance bands. In the dance bands, it was considered kind of the cello of the orchestra to provide the harmonic underpinning of what was going on. And a color instrument, it can blend with anything. And it can sound as bright as a trumpet or as dark as a tuba. And as the players get more musicality to them, there'll be a place for the trombone. more technique, so it sounds more like a musical instrument than a than a circus instrument will help too.
Are you pleased with the balance that you're maintaining now between leading your own dates and playing with the Lee Konitz Nonat and whatever other gigs that you do for steady income?
Well, I like to work more, really. A lot of people don't realize, especially young musicians, that they read about what's going on in New York or wherever, that this is hardly any way to make a living. That is, oh boy, the guy's playing the Village Vanguard or Strikers or wherever. They don't realize that these jobs paying $15 a night or $10 or $20, and that if they had any sense, they would never consider that this is a way to make a living. It's impossible in this day and age to live on making $15 a night.
Is it really that low? $15 a night?
Yes, at Strikers it was. The Vanguard, the last time I worked there, was about $20 with Thad Jones. I think it's up to $25 now, but still, that's the kind of salary that they pay messengers or busboys. In fact, they probably make more than that. jazz players are traditionally been paid very low unless they're a big hit and they have some record or a big audience waiting to hear them. They can get jazz players for peanuts, practically. And there was a time when you couldn't give it away. I remember in Los Angeles going, oh, we just found a place that's got a piano in the back room. Let's bring some drums and a bass there and have a session. And it wasn't that easy. People say, hey, knock it off. We're trying to watch the ball game in here. You couldn't give music away. People couldn't have been less interested in hearing some jazz.
Jimmy Nepper now is a very accomplished trombonist. Do you practice and do things like that to keep in shape, or are the gigs that you play sufficient to keep in the kind of shape you'd like to be?
No, you have to practice. I don't like to practice. In fact, my teacher told me never to practice, but to study, which I guess you could interpret as me being practice, but study and play, he said. And to have any confidence at all, have some strength to do what you want to do, you have to play. Everybody, all the concert violinists and pianists and whatever, all agree on that. You've got to play scales every day and go through your routine and just to stay on a certain level. If you don't, you're going to sink down. And there's a lot of jobs we play where we don't really have to warm up to them that are easy enough. But to do anything that's challenging or to extend your scope, you have to put that time in, preferably every day.